Right, we are continuing in chapter 9 of the various genres of the Old Testament. We have covered Roman numeral 1, narratives, and now Roman numeral 2, we are covering the genre of law. And we've been giving our attention to the various types of Old Testament legal material. And the first of these was what we call casuistic law. It's the it's a word that means a case law. It's, you can recognize it by the if-then. If this happens, then this. The second type of Old Testament law we looked at was apodictic law. Apodictic laws are laws put forward as unconditional. They are categorical directives. They are commands. They are prohibitions. And we said that we can find, we have four different types of these apodictic laws. We talked about casuistic laws, apodictic laws. We said that apodictic laws can be prohibitions. Things like you shall not murder, thou shalt not commit adultery. These are categorical, unconditional, straightforward apodictic prohibitions. They can be admonitions, things that you are commanded to do. Things such as remember the Sabbath day, keep it holy, honor your father and your mother. These are positive statements, admonitions of apodictic law. We talked about participle law. Participle laws are laws, they get their name from the grammatical form. They start off with a participial phrase. There'll be a beginning, if this, then this. This will be the main point. This will be the penalty. So you'll have something, for example, like in Exodus 21:12 that says, whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. Literally, he who strikes, that's the participial setup for this. And then you have shall be put to death. Again, categorical, unconditional, this is what happens. If you strike a man so that he dies, you are to be put to death. No ifs, ands, or buts. Then we talked about the law of retaliation. The law of retaliation, or what we would call the lex talionis, it seeks to articulate equivalency between injury and penalty. It's not necessarily a specific action being called upon, but simply fairness in penalty versus injury. You find in Exodus 21, verses 23 through 25, these words, he shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. And I think all of us recognize that it is not an admonition that if someone gets a stripe, the other person gets a stripe. Or if one person's tooth gets knocked out, you knock out his tooth. It's the point of fairness, equivalency between penalty and injury. One man said it this way, it introduces the principle of proportionality into Israel's law. We talked about number three, legal series. Legal series, you don't usually see laws in isolation. Generally, you will see them in a collection, or what the writers are calling a series. And we want to consider some of these. A series is simply a small number of laws that are phrased in similar style. A short set, similar style, think what? Think Ten Commandments. Series of laws. We talked about topical groups of laws. Topical groups, this is where you would find a lot of the casuistic laws. Laws about altars, laws about slaves, laws about restitution, laws about social justice. We talked about all of that last week. We talked about number four, legal instruction. This is where we ended last week, legal instruction. Legal instruction is under two different categories. I didn't put them on the board, but they're generally either priestly instruction or they are ritual instruction. Priestly instruction, as you might imagine, is instruction that seeks to give instruction to the priests in their professional matters and what they are doing, and then the ritual procedures. Then the ritual instruction, this is directed towards the lay people, what they're to bring to offer. How they're to bring to offer, how it is all to be set up, what are the conditions for that. We said Leviticus chapters 1 through 5 basically give you those instructions to the people of what they're to bring for what specific offering. Is it a burnt offering, a peace offering? What are you to bring and how are you to bring it? How is it to be offered? We finished last week with letter B that's not on the board, but these are principles for the interpretation of the law. And we said that before the writers of our textbook give us various interpretation principles for interpreting law, they laid out four brief observations about Old Testament law. And so I think we got to the first one of those. And the first one of those is this, that some Old Testament laws retain their literal validity for Christians. For example, Jesus reaffirmed in the New Testament the Old Testament injunction to love the Lord with all your heart, all your mind, all your soul, and all your strength. So we see that law in the Old Testament. Well, is that literally valid in the New Testament to the Christian? Well, because Jesus restated that, it certainly is. It is to be literally understood as valid for New Testament Christians. And that's about as far as we got last week. And so let me go ahead and start with the second one of these observations that the writers of our textbook made. They said this, that in, and these are their words, in some cases, the New Testament actually makes the Old Testament laws more strict. I think I would probably want to reword that, that it's not necessarily that Jesus is making them more strict, but he is simply opening up to us the reality that these are not to be understood as something literal, but something that is to be understood as spiritual as well. For the example, the case of marriage, the seventh commandment forbids adultery. Yet you find in the Old Testament that Moses did permit divorce with a writing of divorce paper. And Jesus said, but in, since the beginning, this was not so, that God created them male and female. Man shall leave his wife, his mother and father, and cleave to his wife. And this was the understanding of marriage, and that it was not just to be entered into as long as one person liked the other person. You know, it's not till love, till we don't love each other do we part, right? It's till death do we part. And just because there's one person doesn't, you know, kind of falls out of favor with the other one, well, now we have irreconcilable differences, and so it's okay to be divorced because Moses said it was okay. Jesus said from the beginning it was not so. And so there is that observation made, that there is a strictness, more of a spiritual emphasis made on these laws rather than just a literal, thou shalt not kill, right? Thou shalt not murder, right? That means can I hate someone? I didn't murder him, but can I hate him? Can I hit him? I didn't murder him. Can I hit him? No. This is not the intention of the law, and Jesus brings that out in the New Testament. The third observation that the writers of our textbook make regarding the principles, things that they have laid out regarding the Old Testament law is this. Some laws no longer have literal validity for the New Testament believer because New Testament teachings of this, the fact that they have been fulfilled in Christ renders these literal practices obsolete. Thus, Christians no longer need to follow literally the Old Testament sacrificial system. Right? Nobody brought a lamb to the building last Sunday to sacrifice. We understand that this has been fulfilled in Christ. He is the lamb that God provides for us in the absence of our ability to provide an adequate sacrifice. We are no longer called upon to obey those food laws, that which is clean, that which is unclean. We are not under any obligation to perform any certain ceremonial rites, such as circumcision. There is no New Testament command to literally follow through with the command the Old Testament Hebrews were of circumcision. So that's the third observation that they make, that those that are no longer literally valid because of New Testament teachings that we have. The fourth observation that they make is this. Laws that no longer apply literally still teach important timeless truths. So the Old Testament sacrificial system graphically reminds Christians that God takes sin seriously. So even though we may say, well, we no longer offer sacrifices, we no longer bring two goats and kill one and lay our hand on the other one and let it out in the wilderness, we still understand the great seriousness of sin. This is why these are important to us and for our admonition to know and to understand. And God, because of sin, he requires a great penalty. And of course, he provides that in the person of his own son. And of course, he also offers forgiveness as well when we see these, that God forgives those sins. He passes over those sins. Our confession makes reference to this by calling into our minds general equity. We call this general equity. Even though these laws are not valid, they do present to us now in our day this general equity. Those judicial laws, those ceremonial laws that applied under the Old Testament Israel don't apply in the exact same way to the New Testament believers, but they're morally equivalent. And that moral equivalence applies to us today. And so we can take these laws and apply them to ourselves today in that way, even though they would not be literally valid to us today. So those are some of the observations that they made. There's four of them that they make before they offer up principles for interpreting Old Testament law. And so let me give you those. And there are four of those principles that they offer for interpreting Old Testament law. Number one, whatever its literary type in the law, could be a casuistic law, could be an apodictic law, could be some kind of a law in a series, whatever that particular literary type of law, the collection or the series in which the individual law appears, that the whole series in which that law appears serves as its literal context. And what did we say was primary for our work as interpreters of the Bible? Literary context. Do not pull something out of that context and try to make proper application. You may interpret it correctly and you may be able to do application that way, but that's very dangerous. You always, always, always look at that text and find out what's surrounding it and get the literary context for that before you make application, especially before you make any interpretive remarks. So the collection or the series in which an individual law appears serves as its literary context. And so the student should investigate those surrounding laws for interpretive clues. Look around, what's going on. So how do I best interpret this law as it fits in this whole series of laws? Or is this an apodictic law where there are no conditions to this? This is straightforward, unconditional setup. So you want to look at that. So number two. So basically, what? Literary context. And we've said that till we're blue in the face. And we'll just continue because that's important. Number two, the second principle that they recommend for interpreting Old Testament law. Number two, the student should endeavor to understand the original meaning of laws. In light of their cultural background. Look what's behind that law. This is difficult for us. It's difficult for us to look at laws because we are coming at it from 2,000 years later, sometimes more than 2,000 years later, far more than 2,000 years later. And we read these laws, and they don't necessarily make sense to us. How could you say that kind of a law? That just sounds strange to us for several reasons. First of all, we're more than two millennia removed from that cultural background. Another reason is we are not of this of the Mideastern persuasion. We're Westerners, right? And so we look at it differently. So the writers compel us look at the cultural background, and because we are not aware of that, they recommend that we make good use of commentaries, Bible dictionaries, and other kinds of background resources, histories from properly written perspectives, so that we can get a good understanding of the culture of the day and how this is to be understood in our day. Number three, third principle for interpreting Old Testament law, apply laws primarily to the New Testament counterpart of the original audience. There's an original audience that hears the law. You want to apply that to the New Testament counterpart. They suggest this, for example, laws aimed at Israel as a whole make proper application to Christians in general, to the Lord's people as a church. So these laws that would apply to Israel, while they may not be directly valid for our understanding today, still would apply to the church in general, the Lord's people in general. Since the New Testament affirms the priesthood of the believers, both priestly and ritual instructions should also apply to Christians in general, not just the clergy. So we talk about offering up sacrifices. Is that applied just to the elders of an assembly, just to those who are ordained in some way? Or does that apply to all of the Lord's people offering up their spiritual sacrifices, since we are now a royal priesthood, God's new covenant priests? And so we all offer up those spiritual sacrifices. That's number three. And then lastly, number four, whether a given law applies literally, in principle, or even both. It depends upon how it compares to laws in the categories that we've just discussed above. So what we want to do is use those guidelines in making our application. So we ask this question: which of the four previous observations would apply? Are they to be observed? Are these laws to be applied literally? You would ask that question. Have they been fulfilled in Christ? You would ask that question. Is there a New Testament application that is to be made from this law? You would ask that question. So these are all different. We've made those observations, and then we've given these four principles for interpretation, and the writers of our textbook give us an example text, and then we can take these different pieces that we just talked about and apply them to the text and see how best to interpret that text. Right? So this is a practical exercise in doing all of this. So if you would please, let's turn to Exodus 21, verses 7 through 11. Exodus chapter 21, verses 7 through 11. So here's what we're going to do. This is one of those observations. Whatever its literary type, if it's casuistic, apodictic, legal, whatever it is, the collection or the series in which an individual law appears serves as its literary context. So that's the first thing we want to do. Let's look at the context. Let's read the text, and then we'll look at the context. Exodus 21, verses 7 through 11. Beginning in verse 7. When a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. If she does not please her master, who has designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has broken faith with her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her as with a daughter. If he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights. And if he does not do these three things for her, she shall go out for nothing without payment of money. This is one of those laws where I suggest that you get a book on the culture of the day, because that very first line lands like a hammer on the ears of 21st century Westerners that says, when a man sells his daughter as a slave. You would say, whoa, really? Well, yes, really. This was the culture of the day. There were reasonings behind this, and I would suggest that we look at that. Certainly not getting into all of that tonight. But yes, this was a consolation for this person, this man, this woman, and the fact that she has found disfavor in the man that bought her. And we'll get into a little bit of that as we go. So what kind of law is it, first of all? What kind of a law is it? Anybody want to make a... Is it casuistic, apodictic? Is it a legal series? Legal... What do you think that is? Anybody want to throw out a guess? You're not going to get an A or a B. It's the case law. It's casuistic. It's the case law. If this happens, then this is what's going to take place. All right, so that's casuistic law. It's set within a larger law related to what? What's the larger law? If you start with verse 1 and continue on in that chapter all the way down to, verse 32, what is the whole series about? What's the literary context of this? What kind of law? It's the laws of, I'm cheating because my Bible has it right above the chapter. I have laws about slaves. Laws about slaves, all right, how they'd be treated. And this is just one section. There's lots of places in our Bibles with laws about slaves. This is just one. So that's the context, right, is how are these slaves to be treated? How are they to be taken care of? It's set within the larger law related to slaves. And so verses 7 through 11, those verses concern redemption of an Israelite woman whose father, probably driven by what? Financial necessity, probably has to, has sold her into slave marriage. Right? And this was something allowed, of course, and again, it lands on our ears as coarse and harsh, but this was a consolation to these. A man who, in financial difficulty, could sell a woman into slavery for a certain amount of time. Okay? Okay, so that's the first thing. What's the literary context? It's law about slaves. Excuse me. Number two, we should endeavor to understand the original meaning of laws in the light of their cultural background. All right, we've talked a little bit about this. A male slave does not need redemption because he automatically goes free after 6 years of service. If you look at verse 2 in chapter 21, when you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh, he shall go out free for nothing. So you could not keep that slave forever. You could buy the slave, keep him for 6 years, and then you had to let him go. Another point in this cultural background. This has to do with redemption of a female slave, right? The paying of a debt to free her, right? So, first thing that happened was she was sold for an amount of money to help relieve, and then she would be sold for a certain amount of time, and then this has to do with her, the redemption of that female slave. There are two conditions. Number one, she no longer pleases the man. Right? He's found something disfavorable. He doesn't like her for some reason, so she's not found favor in his eyes. Number two, that's in verse 2. Verse 8. I wrote down the wrong way. Pardon me, verse 8. If she does not please her master, who has designated her for himself. So that's one condition. The second condition is that he has given her legal status as a wife. That's verse 8. He has designated her for himself. Then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people. So he has designated her to himself. And then lastly, there are two things you want to notice. Number one, the woman is protected against abuse by her displeased husband. It forbids him from selling her to a foreigner or from denying her certain spousal rights, things like food, things like clothing, intimate relationships. And then secondly, the reason for the right to redemption is his breach of faith, because he has dealt unfairly with her. She's not pleased him in some way. So he says, and he doesn't want her anymore. So the fault lies with him, that he does not want her anymore. This law makes the loss of favor his responsibility, and it opens the opportunity for her freedom. So those are just some statements regarding the cultural background of that text. There's a lot more, really, but our time is very limited. So there's more to it. Number three, another thing to talk about this. We want to apply laws primarily to the New Testament counterpart. So what would be the New Testament counterpart of this? I want you to note that the law bases marriage in commitments rather than in one member's likes or dislikes. This is a commitment. He has bought her. She is his wife. Just because she falls out of favor, she just should not be punished in some way and penalized in some way. So marriage is not based on that factor. Of course, it's kind of nice when husband and wife like each other, but it's based on a vow made before people to God that you would stay together. What's the old common law, Book of Common Prayers, through thick and thin? What is it? In richer or poorer, sickness and in health, blah, blah, blah. It's based on that vow, that commitment. That's where it rests, not just on some kind of outward circumstances. Also, they make this notation that in protecting a socially vulnerable woman, this is for her protection. This whole thing was to protect her from any abuse from a man who says who bought her as a slave, and now she's fallen out of favor. All right, to let her go. Protecting a socially vulnerable woman, this law applies to God's commitment to protect the vulnerable from abuse. All right, and what do we talk about in the New Testament? It always says, what is true religion? Protect the widows and the orphans, the fatherless. Right, these are the vulnerable among us, and there is this admonition to protect these. Then lastly, we have this. Whether a given law applies literally, in principle, or both depends on how it compares to laws in the categories we've just discussed. So applying this law today would mean this. We couldn't apply it in the case of a woman who is a slave. It's illegal. But there are other applications we can make. What are those? Well, applying this law today would mean an examination of our relationships to see if we are guilty of abusing anyone. Could be a marital relationship, could be a personal relationship. Are we in any way abusing, harming, especially someone who is socially vulnerable? Also, we should protect abused and vulnerable people. So are we guilty of it? We'd ask ourselves, and hopefully we would say no. And then are we doing what we are capable of doing to protect others who may be abused and may be vulnerable people who are being abused, right, being hurt? So that's just one example that the writers give us in this particular case of how we might use these statements of interpretation and apply them to one specific Old Testament law. And of course, you know, there are hundreds, so we couldn't do them all tonight. All right. Any thoughts? Anything you want to contribute or question? Don't ask questions. I'm sorry. Types. What did I? Okay. So what we've talked about, letter B, are the principles. And we gave our attention to a sample text. And the writers of our confession, of our textbook, offer for number two here a separate genre of just Deuteronomy, the book itself. They are saying that, or at least they're suggesting, that Deuteronomy should be seen as a unique literary genre on its own, even though it does represent a collection of laws. They are offering it up as a separate genre to be understood. They say that if you, when you look at Deuteronomy, just because by the name itself, you know that it's a restatement of God's law. Except for the very opening verses, and I think the last few chapters, the whole thing is a restatement of God's laws. But it's set in a unique way. It's set in a series of farewell addresses given by Moses. And so Moses is addressing the people of God and restating all of God's law in these farewell speeches as they listen to him speak. So with that in mind, the writers offer up several interpretations. There are four of these interpretations or principles for interpreting just the book of Deuteronomy. Okay. Here's the first one. Number one, Deuteronomy is best heard. So in other words, when you're reading it, you're hearing it. This is the best way for you to hear it. The best way for Deuteronomy to be heard is as Moses speeches to Israel, who are under the very real danger of compromising their exclusive commitment to the one true God. As you read through it, you know that this whole statement of God's commands being restated is set under this backdrop of Moses' speech to these people, very impassioned speeches, because they are now about to go into the promised land, but a promised land filled with pitfalls, snares, dangers, people who will cause them to compromise their exclusive commitment to the Lord Almighty. Israel's people were different from these other people. To them, the more gods, the better. As long as you've got all your bases covered, great, have more gods. Not the Hebrews, certainly not the believer. We worship God exclusively. No other gods, no compromise, nothing syncretistic. So Deuteronomy is best heard with that backdrop, that they are in danger of compromise. In fact, if you will read through Deuteronomy, you'll read some of those laws. You'll see the penalty getting stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger until what? Until the final penalty of you're going to be taken out of the land. And what did eventually happen to the people of God? They eventually did. They eventually were exiled to Babylon. Number two, here's the second interpretive principle for Deuteronomy. The historical background is the potential for the influence of the Canaanite religion to corrupt the Israelites. You can hear Moses' speeches, the dire warnings against Baal worship. I guess I kind of got ahead of myself on that one. So that's number two. So first of all, Deuteronomy is best heard as Moses speeches to them. Number two, the historical background of the potential for them to compromise. Number three, the writers suggest that we approach the laws of Deuteronomy as Moses' passionate exhortations. In other words, it's a series of farewell speeches just prior to his death and Israel's entry into Canaan. Try not to view it as simply an abstract, technical, legal instruction book. The central issue is that of religious accommodation to idolatry. And then now number four, the literary nature of each section should dictate the interpretive approach. For example, poetic sections require treatment appropriate to poetry. Laws and demand the same thing for laws and for legal materials. So you want to be careful with that. Those are the four principles. Okay. All right, that brings us to Roman numeral 3. That is poetry. Poetry. After narratives in the Bible, we talked about narratives. After narratives, the most common literary form is poetry. And nearly every book of the Bible contains poetry. You're going to find poetry from beginning to end. Poetry is technically not a genre. It is a literary form. And so within poetry as a literary form, you're going to find various genres of that poetic form. So the writers of our textbook present an overview of the major literary types of Old Testament poetry. And then they conclude with some principles for interpretation, as you imagine, as they always have done. So let's first of all look at some types of Old Testament poetry. And the first of these, letter A, is prayer. Prayer. These are specially worded, I just saw the folks here, and I just look at my watch, so I'm a little bit late. So we're going to have to stop there. We'll talk about prayer next week. And so let's bow in prayer, please. Our Father and our God, we again thank you for the privilege of coming before your throne of grace and to offer up our petitions. We thank you for these lessons we've had tonight. And please bless as we gather to pray in Jesus' name. Amen.